Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. I can't emphasize that enough. But I don't have time to go through and help you understand the magnitude of the little time we have. And you got to consider every minute that we have truly a blessing. And with that, without any obligatories, I just want to bring Paul back in because I know Paul still had questions regarding the sheriff, and he possibly had others. So let's go through those questions you've got. Welcome back, okay. Paul.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm back. So Governor Randolph was talking about sheriffs.
Yep.
And there seemed to be an understanding, help me if I'm wrong, that they consider part of the sheriff's job as being a tax collector.
That's correct. And as a matter of fact, during the Whiskey Rebellion, the sheriff was involved in collecting the taxes. And he was shot at. They said, you know, get out of here. We're not going to listen to you because this tax is unfair. So what they did was absolutely, you know, treasonous. It was an insurrection because under the Constitution, if you don't like what government is doing, you have a responsibility to petition them. And they did. Instead of petitioning, they actually said, we're not going to abide by this. And go, well, hey, this is the law. You have to abide by it. And so nobody said, hey, if you don't like it, go petition. You know, put your petition forth. And they could have easily done that in petitioning the state government or the county government or whomever in session at the time, the governor. If there's nobody in session, then they can petition the governor and say, hey, this is unfair. This is not constitutional. And they would have had it resolved by the explanation of how the whiskey tax as an excise tax was deemed as a fair tax. And that if you are not going to abide by this, you will either be arrested for tax evasion, or if you rise up against this, you'll be arrested for an insurrection.
Got it. Okay. Now, here's another question I have.
Okay.
Were the sheriffs also considered the election officials?
Yes. Yeah. So they actually conducted the election. And as a matter of fact, it was well stated and documented that when people moved into a county and they, you know, first time they met the sheriff was at an election, the sheriff actually would not allow them to vote. Even if they were paying their poll tax, he would not allow them to vote if he didn't know that they were actually residents in his county. He had to have some kind of evidence. They didn't just, you know, they paid their tax, which is great, but the sheriff actually had to go out and see them, you know, on their property or what have you to say, okay, you are a resident in my county.
Wow.
So what we are actually seeing is the importance of the formation of state constitutions. This importance really relies upon the parties to the state constitution. And again, people are not perpetual. Our governments are. And when people actually formed states, all new states that were formed in the Union, they were formed under the new model of this constitution. That, in other words, they first had to form counties. And once they had enough counties and enough population, then they were able to actually form a state. But it wasn't the people, it was the counties sending representatives of the county. So, in other words, they didn't send in Wyoming when they hit 59 or 58,000, they didn't send to Cheyenne 20 some thousand people to create a constitution. That would have just been chaos, that would have just been mayhem. And so this is why you have to pare it down to a very small group of people so you can actually get work done.
Correct.
And it's kind of funny how one would think that the more people you have, the more work you can get done. But actually, depending on the type of work, like a bucket brigade, yeah, you can get a lot of work done, right? You can form lots of different lines to have, you know, this massive bucket brigade in putting out a fire. But when it comes to forming government, the only way to get that work done is to have a few select really smart people in one room. Right.
Correct.
And so this speaks to the significance of the counties and how the counties really screwed up those people that they sent because they didn't understand. And most people, because at this point in time, even when the last, one of the last states joined the union, which was Oklahoma, right? It was in 1906 when Oklahoma, one of the early states, that being the last state to join the union, when Oklahoma joined, the government was still not that involved in our everyday lives. The county government was pretty much, you know, very skull and bones. I mean, it was a skeleton feature of government. And the states were pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until the progressive era where all of a sudden government started assuming and literally, you know, kind of mucking things up. Now, in some ways, we did learn that having some form of standards actually improve things. And understanding that, you know, there's no reason why states couldn't have created their own standards and how straight the states could have worked together to create a common standard, but the federal government had no authority to be involved in it, period. And so, anyway, I digress. What, did you have any other questions? Or
no, it's just those duties of the sheriff evolved over time.
They devolved. They didn't evolve. They devolved because the sheriff doesn't do voting anymore, and nor does he collect taxes. He only enforces the law.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, most of the stuff that was on his plate as the sheriff, you know, kind of took, you know, he was really put into the, you're a cop now. Because he wasn't even an executive. And even today, our county governments are not matured enough where they should be, you know, especially in these massive populated areas, they should be far more matured than they are. And the problem is, and the reason why we have all of the problems that we have is because the counties didn't see themselves as becoming so relevant that government would be so involved in our lives that we needed the counties to actually be a stronger political structure in, you know, in the states than the state government. And so this is why the only way to fix this, the only way this can be fixed, is through a constitutional convention at the state level to rewrite the state constitutions so the counties can take back their power.
Mm.
Because in the nature of constitutions, only the parties that formed that constitution truly has, or ultimately has, the utmost power to step in and say, look, we don't like what you've been doing, and we don't like the direction you've gone, and you've really taken away our voice and our representation. And as a matter of fact, you've allowed the federal government to do that. This is why it is necessary that we step back in and reframe the Constitution accordingly.
Mm.
See how powerful that would be if all of a sudden states started doing that?
It would be.
Yes. And what they would basically be doing is they'd be cutting the strings of the federal government over this, you know, that they have on the states. Cut them all.
It has to happen.
Well, I agree.
I don't how quickly. I mean, I think there's got to be maybe an interim way for us to do that because I don't see state constitutions, you know, making that transition that quickly. But
right.
It does. Cutting the federal strings does have to happen.
Well, yes. And, and scaling back the state government, because it's been proven that the more powers get centralized into a smaller body of government, the more tyranny comes forth.
Yes.
And when you actually distribute that power to where, I mean, just imagine where the power exists at the county level throughout the states, that's a huge body of government framework. I mean, we're talking about thousands of counties. And with the power residing at the county level, you know, you could actually streamline your state legislatures. They don't work that much. They really shouldn't probably be paid so much, except for their oversight over the federal government. In other words, so when we start looking at where the money needs to go for government, the money really needs to go towards those who are working full time at the county level. And then the next level would be the state, where the state, those who are working at the state, would, you know, because they have a lot of, they'll be basically the general government for the counties, and they should be serving as the overseers. And we're going to get into this in the presidential series. So I think we'll be getting into some of this stuff in my next episode, where I talk about how the states will actually have to, you know, once they create these committees, these federal review committees, a part of that will be the review of classified information. In other words, making sure that the federal intelligence system is not violating the Constitution by spying on its own people. Are you there? I think I lost you. So I'll
just... You didn't lose me.
Okay.
So it's 3,100 counties in the United States.
Okay. 3,100 counties. And so if that's where the people will be getting, you know, whatever they want, if they want to move their county towards an entitlement county, you know, they would have to actually take over enough counties in the state to move the state towards an entitlement county.
Okay.
But bottom line is the entitlement counties that if the state does that, they need to have it galvanized in their state constitution that the state is not the giver and taker, or the taker and giver. That has to be done at the county expense. In other words, it is wrong for any other county to have to pay, you know, because this other county has a higher population, taking more from everybody in the state to give to those people in the high population area.
So what's the term, quickly, just so I don't miss it in the listeners, what did you mean? You introduced the term entitlement counties.
Yeah, so an entitlement county is where the people in that county want the state to become a teat for them, to give them welfare, to give them services. Well,
right.
The county's limitation of doing that would be based on, you know, how much can they take from the people. And what would end up happening is people would flee that county and go move in the neighboring county and operate their business in the neighboring county, or commute. Because they're not going to want to see their taxes, you know, and you know, their property taken away from them. So you really contain socialism down at the lowest level to where it really can't take a hold, because what you have to do is you have to make everybody in that county suffer because a few people have convinced you to basically take from those who have to give to them who have not.
Right.
And that actually, what that actually will do is this is how we kill the communist system in America. Because counties cannot, they just can't sustain that. They will go bankrupt. And when they go bankrupt, all those laws will be flushed out. And everybody, you know, it's like, who moved my cheese? You know, everybody that's looking for their free cheese will realize the cheese is gone. And they're actually going to have to get a job.
Woo. And then contribute to the system.
There you go.
Free market.
That's right. And they're going to wish that they couldn't, because most of the people today that are doing this are just gaming the system. They're gaming the system because the system allows them to do that. That's why it only grows when that happens, because people are naturally lazy and they're quick to corruption.
Well, it's human nature. Yeah. They seek their own best interest, and if their own best interest allows them to be less productive and still get some gain, they'll do it.
Right.
Okay.
Let's move on, unless you got another topic or another issue.
So it looks like Mr. Madison was talking about safety in the union.
Yep.
Is that where you want to go?
Yep. And it's kind of right. It's kind of a note written by those who were the stenographers, those who were keeping records. So, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Madison then recapitulated many instances of the prevalent persuasion of the wisest patriots of the states that the safety of all America depended on union, and that the government of the United States must be possessed of an adequate degree of energy, or that otherwise their connection could not be justly denominated as a union. He likewise enumerated the expedients that had been attempted by the people of America to form an intimate association from the meeting at New York in the year 1754 downwards, that their sentiments on the subject had been uniform both in their colonial and independent conditions, and that a variety of causes had hitherto prevented the adoption of an adequate system.
Right. Okay. So he just created this historical, you know, overview of how, there was this need for the union, that they needed to actually pull together. And so, I mean, it just became blatant. I mean, he's talking about history that was well before he was born. And so the next one, okay, so Mr. Henry speaks, and then we go into June 9th, Monday. Mr. Henry wasn't done talking, so he talks his way into the beginning of the next day. And then Mr. Lee of Westmoreland gets up, and now we hear a little bit more on the militia.
Okay. And I'm there.
Okay, go ahead.
Our men fighting with the troops of that king whom he so much admires, I have seen proofs of the wisdom of that paper on your table. I have seen incontrovertible evidence that militia cannot always be relied upon. I could enumerate many instances, but one will suffice. Let the gentleman recollect the action at Guildford. The American regular troops behaved there with the most gallant intrepidity. What did the militia do? The greatest number of them fled. The abandonment of the regulars occasioned the loss of the field. Had the line been supported that day, Cornwallis, instead of surrendering at Yorktown, would have laid down his arms at Guildford.
Okay.
I've got to stop.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Now, we promote, we understand how the founders felt about the militia. They put it in the Constitution. It's mentioned six times, but it's only mentioned six times because they understood it. You know, the concept they understood.
Right.
But here, the militia failed. What happened here?
Okay, so prior to the Revolution, there was no union. They didn't have the structure of standards, discipline, and organization. Now, he's talking about the necessity of an army and vice, to fight a war, vice a militia, a state alone militia. And the fact when you pull state militias together for the first time and you have no standards and you have, no organization to them, they lack so much that they don't have the confidence. And this is why he said that, the states were sending up replenishments or men coming from the militia, and those who stayed on to fight the battle with Washington were far more trained and disciplined. And so it was like he points out that the regulars were actually disciplined. They didn't surrender. They didn't run from their ranks, where the militia did, because they didn't have the discipline. And it made them completely vulnerable where they had to give up the land and actually, you know, run to fight another day. And that next day was Cornwallis, you know, when they actually fought that battle to end the war. And so in this new system actually calls for, you know, a regular. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that would have been just, you know, absolutely smart is that if we were at peace, you know, under this new system, then there should have been a necessity to calling up or activating the militia for drill purposes so that they would kind of go through how they would form, how they would function, and how they would operate and actually go through. Because in the military, I remember in the 70s and the 80s, we were constantly having exercises where we played, you know, with opposing forces. You know, we didn't have live ammo or anything, but the opposing forces was kind of like capture the flag type. It was safe, but it was testing the one's ability to, you know, to, you know, contain and, you know, entrap, ensnare, or what have you. And, you know, it was the operation was a dual success because the opposing force to the large force always was, you know, trying to figure out ways to exploit and compromise, you know, this right. this established body. And, you know, and likewise, the established body was trying to make sure that it could react adequately to, you know, contain and to basically overcome this attacking force. So, but they never did that. They never did that. There was okay. never this... this planning and strategic planning for, you know, the defense. So moving forward, because this is what I'm covering. I just actually started this on this past Monday. I'm covering how, you know, the Navy is actually needs to take charge of, you know, the deployment of, you know, the Army. Actually, I would submit that it would be the deployment of the Marine Corps. The Army, the only force that would be called the Army would be the body, federal body, that would be protecting the motherland, protecting America. And I see the need, and we always have this need for that army, because the Army wasn't to deploy. There was no concept of projecting force other than the Navy.
Correct.
And so I make this argument that all these strategic parts of the Army and the Air Force and the Space Force all get melted back into the Navy, where they take care of the strategic mission of guarding us from external threats. And that the Army just gets, you know, reconfigured back out to the militia regulars reconfigured to the state as the original county militias. And then that the state would have their own exercises. And that the states would then, you know, allow Congress would have budget to basically have regular, you know, a winter warfare and a summer warfare so that they could actually be well versed in being able to defend America, you know, in the elements. Because that's the whole purpose of the Army, is to defend the motherland, the homeland. So.
Oh. I think apparently what he's pointing out here is that in the Constitution, the discipline of the militia is specified.
Yes.
Where it wasn't in the, you know, they didn't know what they were doing.
Correct.
Okay? And obviously, you know, you had regulars who had the discipline, they had been in battle, and these people who were in the militia just, hey, is their first,
right.
Is
so there was the, that's what I'm saying. There was this complete lack of discipline. But he's actually speaking in the favor of being able to form and create armies. And so there's no reason. We're going to go into break right now. So just hold on, and then we'll get into the reading. But there was no need. There was no need whatsoever. They couldn't imagine, you know, the strategic importance of being able to exercise, you know, the federalizing of the militia so that these states would know what to do and how to operate. And, you know, when we come back from the break, I'll entertain the concept of what would have happened with the Civil War if we would have had, if we were smarter about this. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let's look at, you know, let's learn from their mistakes. They didn't see the need for actually having standard exercises for, you know, for really getting into the nth degree of standards and, you know, discipline and those types of things. And so had they started implementing these types of things, then there would have been a, you know, from the founding of the Constitution prior to the Civil War, America would have had far greater disciplines. And so at the time of the Civil War, who had most of the experience and who was involved in the armies? Because they actually created a standing army. You do realize that as they created the territories, they formed the standing army to basically protect and execute the laws of the Union. And so they got into the cycle of maintaining instead of utilizing the militia, which was what they really should have been doing. But it was a lot easier to create a regular army, and it was a lot easier to just to keep these people employed than having to deal with the strategic interests. And had they done that, then the poorer portions of America wouldn't have been the strategic interest of America. And what I'm saying is, when you look at who occupied the ranks of the army and our strategic forces at the time of the Civil War, they were almost all Southerners.
Okay.
The core officer corps that actually, you know, I'll just say, seceded from the Union. I mean, the majority of the generals and everything else were Southern generals, and the majority of the people that were involved were these people that didn't have plantations, that may not have had, you know, the affluence, and they, you know, saw their prominence and opportunity in this military army that became a standing army. So when all of a sudden the South seceded, the North was left with, you know, marginal troops at best and no real good, you know, smart strategicians or, you know, strategic thinkers in the Northern Army.
Okay. So we had this provision in the Constitution, but we really didn't use it effectively.
That is correct. And as a matter of fact, they went down the path of ease, if you know what I mean. In other words, they, you know, it's a lot easier to just do this than it is to rely upon the state militias and actually form the discipline that they needed out of the militias.
Mm-hmm.
So my point being is that, you know, they actually thought it would be better to keep a standing army, and that's what they did. And I believe that they made a huge mistake because the Southern War actually exploited that. The South actually would have won that war had it not been for Lincoln. Had Lincoln actually done the right thing in the first place, I think that the war would have ended a lot faster, first off. But I do believe that, you know, he had to learn his lesson. Lincoln had to prostrate himself to say, okay, it's not about me, God. What do you want me to do?
Okay.
Okay.
Wow. Okay. Where are we now?
So we're on the militia, right? Or actually, right. We just did the militia of...
An enumeration, right?
Yep.
Mr. Lee?
Right.
Okay, enumeration.
Correct.
Followed by enumerated powers. There we go. I say that this new system shows in stronger terms than words could declare that the liberties of the people are secure. It goes on the principle that all power is in the people and that rulers have no powers but what are enumerated in that paper. When a question arises with respect to the legality of any power exercised or assumed by Congress, it is plain on the side of the governed, is it enumerated in the Constitution? If it be, it is legal and just. It is otherwise arbitrary and unconstitutional. Candor must confess that it is infinitely more attentive to the liberties of the people than any state government. So, you know, he asked a question that I've been asked, and I asked it throughout my campaign last year. And here's the question. And I said, why don't you, and this is what I would say to my audience, why don't you ask this question? Is it constitutional? Nobody asked this question, GR. You notice that?
Yeah.
No one asked it. If you know, someone makes a proposal, who is asking, is it constitutional? And we watch our politicians on a national state level, and I'm telling you, I don't hear that question. The only person I ever heard consistently ask that question are two representatives. One, I didn't know enough about politics to know who he was, but one is Ron Paul, okay, who would actually ask, is it constitutional? I don't know that anyone else has done that except for Larry McDonald, who was a representative in the 80s.
The problem shouldn't be the representatives. Ron Paul shouldn't be the one asking that question. The problem,
right.
The reason that we have these problems is because the people are not right. asking that question.
Correct. And that leads to another thing. What we've devolved into is hero worship. And when I say, so Ron Paul asks these questions, that people are propping up this Ron Paul, right?
Right.
And then you watch the Republican Party stab his campaign, two presidential campaigns in the back, 2008 and 2012, and they still don't get the message. Now what the people have done is they propped up their heroes, whether it's, you know,
whether it was Ron Paul.
Right, it was Ron Paul. And now it's Donald Trump or whoever.
Well, let's be honest. Let's be honest. In 2008, you know,
right.
there was the who's the greatest. And I look at it as a sea of princes or monarchies, because you call it hero. I look at it as more of, because I've referred to our form of government being one of a political, or actually a party, a monarchical party, democratic socialist form of government. That's how I frame it, right? So a monarchical party means that the parties have their princes and kings who they anoint to possibly serve the king, you know, to fill the national king seat.
Right.
And, you know, and then they have all of this part, they have all of this power based on the democracy concept of being able to institute socialism.
Okay.
So that's how we actually have a monarchical party, democratic, socialistic form of government.
Right. But I think the point you made here and why we're doing this is, isn't it time for the people to ask, is it constitutional?
Yes, we need the people to ask that question. Absolutely.
Right. Okay. All right.
All right.
You want me to Enumerated power. Mr. Lee then said that under the state governments, the people reserved to themselves certain enumerated rights and that the rest were vested in their rulers, that consequently, the powers reserved to the people were but an inconsiderable exception from what were given to their rulers, but that in the federal government, the rulers of the people were vested with certain defined powers, and that what were not delegated to those rulers were retained by the people. The consequence of this, he said, was that the limited powers were only an exception to those which rested in the people, and that they knew what they had given up and could be in no danger. He exemplified the proposition in a familiar manner. He observed that if a man delegated certain powers to an agent, it would be an insult upon common sense to suppose that the agent could legally transact any business for his principal, which was not contained in the commission whereby the powers were delegated, but that if a man empowered his representative or agent to transact all his business except certain enumerated parts, the clear result was that the agent could lawfully transact every possible part of the principal's business except the enumerated parts, and added that these plain propositions were sufficient to demonstrate the inutility and folly, were he permitted to use the expression, of bills of rights. This is the same as the example that you use of a power of attorney.
Absolutely. So what is enumerated is all that they can function. If you enumerate general powers, then you have surrendered, you know, the ability for them to fully oppress you.
Right.
They can take your money. They can take your property. Nothing is sacred.
Right.
Right. And that the Bill of Rights actually becomes more dangerous, because this is how... I'll just say soothsayers or worm tongues, you know, people that can actually lie really well, they can start using the Bill of Rights to say, you know, we look at the right of religious expression as being, you know, equally important to allow very destructive religious expression to be honored, you know, which is why they're actually created this. You know, in the protection of Islam, they've attacked Christianity in the schools. And so this is how they use the Bill of Rights to actually twist them into functioning opposite. So when it says Congress can make no law respecting religion, well, when the Scopes trial came along, they actually made a law deciding that the new religion to be taught in the education system would be secular godlessness and no longer Christianity. How is that not a law respecting religion and religious expression? So, you know, Congress didn't make that law. The court did. Well, at that point in time, Congress, you know, they understood only Congress could create laws. The federal courts couldn't even do that. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't even have dared to do that until there was a cooperation of how the branches would work together so that Congress would not complain if there was a violation of the separations of power. And technically, the state should have been all over all of these violations of the separations of power, such as Plessy v. Ferguson.
Right.
Such as the sick chicken. You know, the sick chicken ruling, which was like in the early 1900s, or, you know, it was a labor issue. But anyway, so, yeah.
So Congress kind of keeled over. Okay, they should be jealously guarding their exclusive power to create legislation. Instead, they keeled over.
Yeah, because it benefited them because the court was able to aggrandize federal jurisdiction unconstitutionally.
Got it. And that's where the states needed to pick up and jealously guard their authority, you know, as independent states. But
yes,
they didn't do that either.
No.
Okay. All right.
Okay, so moving down, Governor Randolph now addresses this thing called exclusive legislation. And so actually, let me see here.
I just have...
You know what? Let's skip this one because I didn't highlight it. So forgive me because we actually go down into the interposition of the council or interposition of the president not to have a council. So go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. The same reasons could not be impressed on all the states. I shall mention one example. I shall suppose, for instance, that we shall propose as an amendment that the president shall have a council. I conceive a council to be injurious to the executive. The counselors will either impede or clog the president, or if he be a man of dexterity, they will be governed by him. They will also impair his responsibility. Is it probable that all the other states would think alike on the subject or agree to such an alteration? As there is a mode in the Constitution itself to procure amendments, not by reference to the people, but by the interposition of the state legislatures, will the people of Virginia bind themselves not to enter into this union till amendments shall have been obtained? I refer it to any gentleman here, whether this may not entirely exclude us from the union. Okay, I have to confess, I don't know what's going on here. First of all, it's what do they mean by the president shall have a council. I mean, the president has a cabinet.
Okay, so let me have you started from the top because I really just tried to highlight this one part. But
okay,
go ahead and start it from the top and see if that helps make sense for you more.
He started from the top.
He observed that the only question was with respect to previous and subsequent amendments. Were this the only question, sir, I am sure that this inconsiderable matter would not long retard a decision, that part there. So go on from there.
All right. I conceive the preservation of the union to be a question of great magnitude. This must be a particular object of my attention unless I depart from that rule which has regulated my conduct since the introduction of federal measures. Suppose, contrary to my expectation, this convention should propose certain amendments previous to its ratification. Mild and pliant as those states may be who have received it unanimously, flexible as those may be who have adopted it by a majority. I had rather argue from human nature that they will not recede from their resolutions to accommodate our caprice. Is there no jealousy existing between the states? They discover no superiority in any one state or arrogating to itself a fight to dictate what ought to be done. They would not see the reasons for such amendments, for some amendments in themselves are really dangerous.
Okay, now this is where the original. Okay, so the same reason could not be impressed on all the states. I shall mention one example. I shall suppose, for instance, that we shall propose as an amendment that the president shall have a council. I conceive a council to be injurious to the executive. The counselors will either impede or clog the president, or if he be a man of dexterity, they will be governed by him. They will also impair his responsibility. Is it probable that all the other states would think alike on the subject or agree to such an alteration? As there is a mode in the Constitution itself to procure amendments, not by the reference to the people, but by the interposition of the state legislatures, will the people of Virginia bind themselves not to enter into the union till amendments had been obtained? I refer to it, to any gentleman here, whether this may not be an entirely, it may entirely exclude us from the union. See, the question is whether they're going to become a part of the union or not. And the question is that, you know, if the amendments are wise, all the states will go along with it.
Okay.
That, you know, and he was basically using this interposition that the states would have, not the interposition by the people, but the state legislatures, you know, in being able to actually, you know, protect the states from the government getting in inappropriate powers, like the creating a council for the government or for the president. Now, technically, the presidents eventually did create a council because they created executive departments.
Okay.
And that was kind of a part of that. But when we look today, you know, that we could easily see how some presidents were really, you know, hands-on, where they were controlling them. And or we've seen the otherwise where, you know, the president would actually put in some really nefarious. Obama was really good at this. He put in nefarious people that had their own agendas and actually went down and, you know, because they weren't under his control. They were all doing the globalist plan.
Right.
So if you remember, there was a gentleman called Van Jones that was in him?
Yeah.
And he was kind of the czar of a council. And so he had the delegated power from Obama to be able to drive. And this is when all of a sudden they go, hey, you know, who is this guy? And he got impugned based on his character. But the whole point here is that the state legislatures, when it came down to the federal government obtaining any new powers or an amendment, was, you know, would have been wise enough to ensure that powers that would be perilous to the states would not be, you know, handed out. And that if it was coming to the point where they were going to be placing those, the state legislature would still be able to interpose in keeping those amendments from actually gaining, you know, the ground, because it comes to the state legislatures, not the people. The amendments actually come to the state legislatures. Even when it is done by convention of the people, they still have to set up delegates that really it still comes through the legislature. So who establishes how those delegates are going to be formed out of the state? When the Constitution went out to each of the states, it basically said it was to be ratified in a convention by the people, and the state actually had to determine, and what they all determined was they went by county. Now, the state legislature now could actually go by congressional district instead of county.
Right.
You know, which would actually favor the population centers more. And so anyway, but this is how we've digressed and we've moved away from, you know, the true Republican form of government by county and gone into this, you know, apportionment by people, or basically democracies. The states have been realigned into democracies. But anyway, that's the whole point of, you know, and the real bottom line he's saying is they kept on trying to sell this idea that let's just not ratify and put our, you know, our demand on these amendments, that we won't join the union unless we got these amendments. So,
okay, that clarifies.
Okay.
I said, where is he going with this?
So this Henry, one of, you know, when Henry lost the vote on the commission of the delegates going into the Constitution, they exceeded their commission. He lost that, and they went into debating. So they started demanding that a Bill of Rights be had first. And attached to all of this was that they wanted to ratify contingent to the receipt of very specific amendments.
Okay.
In other words, they were willing to say, well, we'll join if you give us these amendments. And in other words, that would have been one state holding the federal government hostage, or holding the union hostage, to say, we think we're important enough to say you have to give us these amendments.
All right. Now it's in context. That's the context I didn't have.
Okay.
Where's he going with this?
All right. Okay. So now we get into the general defense and welfare. And, you know, Randolph was a pretty smart guy, and he wasn't that good. You know, in some ways he communicated well, but anyway, but there was a lot more to that than what we had. So I've expanded the highlight to the beginning. So go ahead.
General defense and welfare. The sweeping clause, as it is called, is much dreaded. I find that I differ from several gentlemen on this point.
Okay, so hold on here. The sweeping clause is the necessary and proper clause.
Okay.
That's that. Right. That was the pet name that they gave that clause. They called it the sweeping clause because it gave them sweeping powers. At least that's what the anti-federalists were presenting in the Virginia ratification debates. So okay. Go ahead.
This formidable clause does not in the least increase the powers of Congress. It is only inserted for greater cautions and to prevent the possibility of encroaching upon the powers of Congress. No sophistry will be permitted to be used to explain away any of those powers, nor can they possibly assume any other power but what is contained in the Constitution without absolute usurpation. Another security is that if they attempt such a usurpation, the influence of the state governments will nip it in the bud of hope. I know this government will be cautiously watched. The smallest assumption of power will be sounded in alarm to the people and followed by bold and active opposition. I hope that my countrymen will keep guard against every arrogation of power. I shall take notice of what the honorable gentleman said with respect to the power to provide for the general welfare. The meaning of this clause has been perverted to alarm our apprehensions. The whole clause has not been read together. It enables Congress, quote, to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States, end quote. The plain and obvious meaning of this is that no more duties, taxes, imposts, and excises shall be laid than are sufficient to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States.
Okay, so he didn't do a really good job here, but there's another point in time where we'll actually get him to finally say what was necessary.
Okay.
And what he says is that there are no general powers, because they came back and said, yeah, okay, so this right here is a general power. Now, just think, so, okay, just so let's look at it this way. If you took Article 1, Section 8, and this, to lay taxes for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, but all of these taxes shall be uniform throughout the states. Well, if they wouldn't have listed the resulting powers that they were delegating, then that would have been a general power, because they had the power to lay taxes to pay all the debt. The purpose of doing that was to promote or provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. So this is where Congress would then have the discretion to say, well, we think that this would serve the general welfare of all of the Union. So, again, I can't believe it. We ran out of time again. And so, folks, we'll carry this over. And as a matter of fact, I know Paul is thinking, hey, well, I've got some questions regarding the necessary and proper and this general power. So in our next episode, we'll pick it up right where we left off. So have no fear, folks. We've been successful doing that so far. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved and supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.